Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started. Again, we're super excited to have Nan with us today. This has been so much fun, actually, to have three of us, and we're a little long-winded, but it's all good. Okay, so Nan, you're going to start us.
And I will work hard today to be less long-winded, as I think this is probably the longest section that we worked on. In my version of the book, it's about 70 pages. It's the same number of chapters, but a couple of these chapters are pretty lengthy. So where we left off, last time we discussed at length Darcy's terrible proposal and the aftermath of that. And over time, Elizabeth has come to realize, like, ooh, Darcy was probably not the bad guy all along. She hasn't really discussed much of this with anybody except some of it with Jane. Between them, they decide that they're not going to expose Wickham. They're left to just both feel a little bit lonely and disappointed. But Elizabeth has a scheme to go up into the countryside with her aunt and uncle. So she's going to get a little bit of a holiday for a few weeks, kind of a spring break trip, I guess you'd say. While they're on this trip, they decide that they're going to go visit Pemberley, which is Darcy's home, but only because they learn that the family is away. So Elizabeth is kind of overcome with curiosity, and this is where we're going to be. So chapter 43 picks up with their visit to Pemberley. So what I'm going to do first is, because this is a long chapter, I'll give just like a few sentences summary, and then I'm going to go back in and pick out some favorite parts. Because it's a novel, of course, she's going to run into Mr. Darcy at Pemberley. Of course, right? You can see that coming from a mile away. But what happens first is that while they're at Pemberley, yes, the grounds are beautiful. Elizabeth is a little overwhelmed. And once again, is struck by the fact that I can't believe this guy proposed to me. Like, really? And because she's more inclined to have positive feelings about them now, she's feeling quite flattered and overwhelmed at the same time. And the housekeeper is the one who shows them through most of the house. And the housekeeper is just effusive in her praise of Mr. Darcy. She has kind of a quick throwaway comment for Mr. Wickham that he's turned out very wild, but she has nothing but positive things to say about Darcy, revealing aspects of his character that even though Elizabeth has come to have softer feelings towards him, the housekeeper reveals things Elizabeth never saw about him. One thing that she emphasizes is his generous spirit and how kind he's always been to everybody that lives in and around the estate. It strikes Elizabeth also that just how many people Darcy has within his power to cause damage in their lives or to help them. And she's realizing just how much he must have to keep track of. She kind of saw him as sort of just a prideful aristocrat. And instead she's seeing him more in his element for what he would really be here. So then they go out to walk across the grounds. And coming around the corner, she sees Mr. Darcy. And for those fans of the BBC series, this is the very, very famous scene. But I do want to debunk something right here. The way that the brilliant director in the BBC version plays it is Darcy comes, doesn't see them, is very hot and sweaty after a day on the road or riding his horse. He has his shirt on, but he goes for a swim in his own pond. So when he runs into Elizabeth, he's just walked out of the pond and he's dripping wet. The conversation that ensues and the way those actors play that is very much as written in Austen. It's clear he's a little disheveled that he's just come from the road, but no, Austen did not throw Darcy in the water. That's very much a director's choice from the BBC version and maybe one of the most famous scenes.
I've seen all these different things where people really think that there is a scene that he's like walking up out of the water. Have you seen that though, where like, I think in like Austen Land or whatever that silly movie was, the lady's like, okay, go get in the water and then slowly walk out. And I'm like, that didn't even happen in the movie. Like,
yeah.
It was so funny.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Well, so, yeah. I mean, and in Austen Land, that main character, she fully recognizes that she's just as obsessed with the movies and especially yeah. She is. The book is dedicated to Colin Firth, Austen Land.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I like it. That's hilarious.
Another pop culture moment, probably because in response to this, that I picked up on over the weekend that made me laugh. So I know it's controversial for whatever reason. I adored the Barbie movie. I had a blast at it over the weekend. There is a scene in it where they kind of are writing different Barbies into it. And I think one of them is like stay at home bookish Barbie or whatever. And she's watching on her computer screen and it's part of Pride and Prejudice. Yeah, they don't show too many like movie culture clips in there, but Pride and Prejudice is one of them. And I was like, oh. Kind of fangirl.
Perfect.
Then she talks to Darcy, doesn't introduce him to her aunt and uncle. Clearly, there's this crazy moment of awkwardness between them. It's the first time they've seen each other since he put that letter in her hand. And it's the first time they've really spoken to each other since she threw his proposal back in his face. So, of course, everything is horrible and awkward. But just the fact, I think, that they're both awkward, she recognizes that there's like clearly still feelings there. And even Elizabeth can see it this time because he was certainly not calm when he saw her talk to her, but obviously wasn't irritated either. So then he kind of runs in the house, but before they leave, because they keep going around the grounds, before they leave, Mr. Darcy comes back. And this time he's changed his clothes. He's cleaned up a little bit. He's extremely civil to them. He's very kind to her aunt and uncle. He says that he's got some folks coming to the house that she already knows. So this is going to be Bingley and his sisters are coming for a visit. But he makes a special point of saying that his sister is going to be with them and he very, very much wants. Well, he doesn't even say it this way. It's not that he wants Lizzie to meet his sister. It's that he says Georgiana is very interested in making your acquaintance, which would definitely indicate that Darcy has been talking about her and that Miss Darcy, Georgiana, has heard of Lizzie probably from Darcy. Yeah, about the only thing we hear about Mr. Wickham is from this housekeeper. He's gone into the army. I'm afraid he's turned out very wild. And that's important because later on, when Wickham and Elizabeth, several chapters later, get a chance to speak again, Wickham sort of tries to imply that there's a housekeeper there who had really, really fond feelings for him. But this is all she says about Wickham and says nothing but praise for Mr. Darcy. We know that Mr. Darcy spends as much as half the year out in the country, which I think could be significant as we are going to see Mr. Darcy in his element here, whether it's because of changes that have been come about to his character as a result of what Elizabeth said to him, or just because he's more himself in the country. We see that country Darcy is very, very different than Hertfordshire Darcy and definitely different than London Darcy. If your master would marry, you might see more of him. Elizabeth says that. And, or Mrs. Gardner maybe says it, one of the two of them says it. And then the servant says, it was Mr. Gardner said it. Yes, sir. But I don't know when that will be. I don't know who's good enough for him. Mm-hmm. And with Darcy's mother dying when he was fairly youngish, you can see she kind of takes some ownership for him. And then she says, it's not just me that's saying this. Anybody who knows him in this atmosphere would say exactly the same thing about him. And then other character traits we get, he was always the sweetest tempered, most generous hearted boy in the world. And then Mrs. Gardner says, well, his father was an excellent man. Yes, ma'am, that he was indeed. His son will be just like him, just as affable to the poor. He's the best landlord that ever lived, not like the wild young men nowadays who think nothing of themselves. There is not one of his tenants or servants, but will give him a good name. Some people call him proud. I never saw anything of it. To my fancy, it's only because he doesn't rattle away like other young men. Maybe he's a little aloof and reserved, but she sees that as a sign of maturity and goodness and his willingness to take responsibility for things. I've never known a crossword from him in my life. I've known him since I was 4 years old. Clearly, she has a lot of good things to say about him. Now, the other thing is they go into a picture gallery and she's looking at some different images and things like that. And of course, she's kind of focused on Mr. Darcy's picture. The housekeeper warms up to Elizabeth immediately when she finds out that she's acquainted with him. Does it look like him? Is he handsome? Yes, he's very handsome. So there were miniatures they looked at, but also kind of a portrait gallery. At last, the picture of Mr. Darcy arrested her. She beheld a striking resemblance to the actual Mr. Darcy with such a smile over the face as she remembered to have sometimes seen when he looked at her. She stood several minutes before the picture in earnest contemplation and returned to it again before they quitted the gallery. Mrs. Reynolds informed them that it had been taken in his father's lifetime. So there's some indication here that maybe Darcy was happier and more lighthearted when his father was alive. You know, they don't say exactly when, but Darcy probably inherited all of this as a really, really young man, like probably in his early 20s. And he's been a guardian to Georgiana for most of her all of her teenage years and for a long time. And this is a huge responsibility for a very young man to have to take on. And so he didn't get a chance to kind of like have as much fun or sow some wild oats like other young men of his class. He succeeded to this huge responsibility at a very young age. And so suddenly Elizabeth is starting to see some of what she viewed as pride, maybe as just seriousness, because he's had to take on this big responsibility. But I do love that idea that she finds a picture and he's kind of smiling and she's like, oh, that's what it looks like when he smiles. I've seen his expression, that expression sometimes when he looks at me. And that's kind of the first indication we get that Elizabeth is now kind of redissecting all of their interactions from the very beginning, not just since she got the letter. She thought of his regard with a deeper sentiment of gratitude than it had ever raised before. She remembered its warmth and softened its impropriety of expression. So I do think that this sometimes happens is when we meet somebody and we come to have a different opinion about them than we had in the beginning. I think forgiveness can soften the negativity of some memories that we have. Now, that's not going to always be the case, right? Like some things that have happened to us are just too egregious. But in the case of Darcy and her interactions with him, as she's coming to this place where she's forgiving him, she's suddenly seeing a lot of things in a new light, the way he spoke to her, the way he interacted with her, and some of his impropriety towards her is suddenly either not looking so bad or she realizes that she's kind of willing to forgive it. So then, yeah, she walks around the corner. They're out on the grounds and she's feeling all these big feelings about Darcy. And she's never expecting to see him ever again. And then he walks around the corner and she runs into him. And it says the cheeks of both were overspread with the deepest blush. So they're both highly embarrassed. He was startled. He wasn't able to speak to her in terms of perfect composure, but at least he did have perfect civility. So the take-home note there is your manners can save you. having good manners can actually like pull you out of awkward situations. They're not able to really talk. And he does ask after her family. And this is another one of those situations where Austen sort of tells us what they said instead of actually writing the dialogue mm-hmm. for it, which leaves some things open to interpretation. That's another one in the dripping wet BBC Darcy version. He asks her the same question two or three times, but in different ways. How's your family? Everybody's well. And your family? They're well. It's awful and it's awkward. And it is polite to inquire after her family, but it also indicates a kindness that Darcy is trying to show about her family in the full recognition that the last time they spoke, he was very, very unkind about her family. She is kind of hanging on to her last little vestige of prejudice towards Darcy here, though. There's a line that says she was overpowered by shame and vexation. So this is one of the first times we see Elizabeth really embarrassed. Elizabeth is pretty good at being herself and she is seldom embarrassed, if only because she is civil. She does have good breeding. She has excellent manners. She's self-aware, right? But she's really embarrassed over this. And it says, in what a disgraceful light might it not strike so vain a man? In other words, it's going to look like she showed up in the hopes of seeing him or that she's still kind of dangling after him. This is like breaking up with the ex and then showing up somewhere where you know they're going to be and then pretending it's just a coincidence when you run into them. So she's still thinking, oh, this is going to really gratify his pride. The fact that I showed up here and it looks like I'm still dangling after him. But that line right there is, I think, about the last time we get any negative thoughts about Darcy from Elizabeth. So he leaves, goes in the house, changes. When he comes back out, he is going to now be introduced to Mr. and Mrs. Gardner. And Elizabeth isn't quite sure how he's going to take her relations that are from Cheapside. But what we see all through this section is Darcy is really, really different here. And it's kind of a tricky question to say, is it because of what Lizzie said to him? Is his disposition really changing? Or is it the effect of him being on his home territory, his home turf? He feels more comfortable here. We're definitely going to see over the next couple of chapters that I feel like the real Darcy finally stands up. His character is going to be revealed. But there is also this sense, and he will admit it later in the book to Elizabeth, is that he has begun working on himself in response to what Lizzie said to him. I feel like all through this chapter is where we see this like Darcy effect taking place. This to me is the real reason that women are in love with Mr. Darcy. It's yes, he's fabulous and he has his 10,000 a year and he's really handsome and all these things. But this idea that he would take to heart the things the woman he loves tell him, and then he would change as a result of that. You know, for good or for bad, this might be where the real damage Mr. Darcy has done to womankind here is that this belief that love will change people. And love does change people, but it changes them slowly over time. If love is consistent, I think couples change together. I think women change in response to love too. But this idea that a man would do a sea change because of the love of a woman is very Darcy. Maybe a little less realistic, but so sweet in this novel. The other one is she's searching around for a topic to talk about as she's introducing him to her family members. And she ends up kind of having a long conversation with him because they're walking around the grounds and her aunt and uncle have fallen way behind. So she ends up at the carriage with Mr. Darcy first and just can't find anything to talk about. So the first thing that she tries to talk about is she talks about how amazing the grounds are and how lovely and how beautiful and everything is. But then she stops herself because she's like, oh, he's going to think that I'm like hoping he'll propose again because now I like his house. Elizabeth was not comfortable. That was impossible. But she was flattered and pleased because she can see that Mr. Darcy is making such an effort. There's also one other person in the party who more particularly wishes to be known to you. Will you allow me, or do I ask too much to introduce my sister to your acquaintance during your stay at Lambton? That's huge right there. That is the one thing that's got Elizabeth convinced that he might be interested in her still. He wasn't just being polite. That phrase could really, that's one of those ones that girls will dissect over and over again, is that Miss Darcy clearly already knows enough about Elizabeth to have asked after her. She wanted to talk, but there seemed to be an embargo on every subject. So it's just too much.
I love though that she suddenly is like, but then she remembered that she'd been traveling. So she's
like, right.
Oh, I can talk about the places I've been traveling to.
Yeah, those would be safe topics. But anything they really want to talk about is too taboo. There's no way to talk about it. Then the other thing is because of how much Elizabeth has hidden from everybody, even Mrs. Gardner, who she really cares about a lot, Mrs. Gardner is like, okay, so he's not who we thought he was. And then she's like, what's going on here, Elizabeth? And Elizabeth's like, I don't know. I was never more surprised by his behavior to us. It was more than civil. It was really attentive. And there was no necessity for such attention. His acquaintance with Elizabeth was very trifling. So her aunt and uncle just think like, but this was odd because he hardly knows our niece, but he was so friendly. And then what's going to come over the next few chapters is they become quite convinced that the truth is that Darcy is madly in love with Elizabeth, just like her friend Charlotte did all those months before, right? And of course, they're not going to be very far off the mark. So then chapter, that's all 43. So 43 is this huge, big, lengthy chapter.
I was thinking, I need a chart. I don't now because I'm kind of understanding where everything is, but like I wanted like a chart that says what the different houses are called and whose house they are and where they are. So that was one thing. But this week I was finally starting to like, okay, I know Longbourn is Elizabeth's house and Pemberley is Darcy's house. And what was the one you said is Mr. and Mrs. Gardner's house?
Well, their houses have a name, but they live in Cheapside.
Lambton. What's that?
That's the little village that in Derbyshire that sort of like sounds like it's sort of the one that Pemberley oversees. Okay. Is what it seems like, but it's the village right there near Pemberley.
And then you have Rosings,
yeah, where Catherine de Bourgh lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's just complicated. The other thing is, I wanted to ask is sometimes, and I don't know if this is every book, but my version, whenever they're talking about like the regiment or whatever, it's like a line, like a dash. And it, like,
I'm glad you brought that up because I that is very common in like many old books. And I actually wanted to ask Nan if you have any insight into that, because
Thomas Hardy does that sometimes too.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes I've wondered if they want just like a generic county in England somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a fiction, so they're not trying to imply that this story took place anywhere here, but it only ever happens when they talk about the militia in this one.
And then, well, like, there's a couple of names too.
Yeah.
That it like will
a
just
street
be
name.
Like, yeah, there'll be a street name, but then it seems like there's a name of a person as well. They just like sort of leave it blank. And there's like a literal blank
line.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to look that up, and then we should find the next one, because that had run it. You know, it's funny because that had hit me last night too. And I was like, oh, we should look this up because people will be curious about that. We'll see if I can find it. Some of it, yeah, I've sometimes wondered if it's because it's referencing like real people doing a real thing, and she's trying to not imply that they're part of the story. The other thing is, this is published like while the Napoleonic War is still going on. So there are regiments that are kind of moving around. Like, being a soldier was a big deal. If, you know, like, chances are Wickham's going to have to go fight sometime. Like, because a lot of the soldiers, even the ones who purchased commissions, had to do that. What happens the next morning is Elizabeth, she won't talk to her aunt and uncle about this. They're both totally convinced that Darcy's in love with her. And shockingly enough, pretty much as they come into town, they stop at the inn to visit with them. And Elizabeth wasn't really quite expecting that. They didn't necessarily stick close to home. They still went out and did their morning visits. And then sure enough, the carriage pulls up and Miss Darcy comes in to meet her. And then Mr. Bingley is with them too. I love this interaction because Bingley's sisters aren't with them. It's Bingley and Darcy and Georgiana and Elizabeth and Elizabeth's aunt and uncle. And it's pretty friendly and kind of open and kind of delightful. And what is so funny is that Elizabeth is still so stressed out, because I love this. Elizabeth on her side had much to do, even though it's just a conversation, right? Elizabeth had much to do. She wanted to ascertain the feelings of each of her visitors. She wanted to compose her own and to make herself agreeable to all. And in the latter object, where she most feared to fail, in other words, making herself agreeable, she was most sure of success. For those to whom she endeavored to give pleasure were prepossessed in her favor. Bingley was ready, Georgiana was eager, and Darcy determined to be pleased. And I just love that, thinking that sometimes we're so anxious about how others perceive us, but when you're around people who really care about you, they want to be pleased, and they will overlook some of your more negative qualities, maybe. And I think sometimes, especially around people we care about, maybe we're trying too hard to always do or say the right thing. Because I think that's very sweet, is that once she's away from Bingley's sisters, this is a group of people who really, really want to like her, and she kind of can't screw up in their eyes. And so, yeah. And just that turn of phrase, I think, is extremely Austen and so sweet. This is a section too, where as she's talking to Bingley, she becomes increasingly convinced that Bingley does still really like her sister. And it was this one, they were commenting on how long it's been since they've been together. Bingley said, it was above 8 months. We've not met since the 26th of November, when we were all dancing together at Netherfield. Elizabeth was pleased to find his memory so exact. And even though they can't get a chance to really talk about Jane, Bingley does make a point of saying, are all your sisters still at Longbourn? Because he's very interested to find out. I mean, he might assume that Jane's married and gone off by this time, right? And he clearly does not want that to be the case. She says this of Darcy: never, even in the company of his dear friends at Netherfield or his dignified relations at Rosings, had she seen him so desirous to please, so free from self-consequence or unbending reserve as now, when no importance could result from the success of his endeavors, and when even the acquaintance of those to whom his attentions were addressed would draw back the ridicule and censure of the ladies both at Netherfield and Rosings. So this is the first time she's seen Darcy act halfway natural in conversation without any kind of artifice. And she's like, and he can't even get anything out of it because I've already told him no. So he can't be doing this just to try to like trick me. This, for the first time, I think Elizabeth feels like this is him. This might be the real Darcy here that I'm finally uncovering, or at least the best version of Darcy that she's seen yet. And so Mr. and Mrs. Gardner are very curious, but they also know it doesn't work to force communication. And they are looking around at this group and they're like, well, somebody's in love with somebody. And we don't know what Elizabeth's feelings are yet, but we're sure that Mr. Darcy is in love with our niece. And then the last thing here, she goes through this big exploration of her feelings from the first time she met him till where she is now. And she realized that one of the main feelings that she's feeling is just gratitude towards him. It was gratitude, not merely for having him once loved her, but for loving her still well enough to forgive all the petulance and acrimony of her manner in rejecting him and all the unjust accusations accompanying her rejection. Such a change in a man of so much pride, exciting not only astonishment, but gratitude. For to love, ardent love, it must be attributed. And as such, its impression on her was of a sort to be encouraged, as by no means unpleasing, though it could not exactly be defined. She respected, she esteemed, she was grateful to him. She felt a real interest in his welfare, and she only wanted to know how far she wished that welfare to depend upon herself, and how far it would be for the happiness of both that she should employ the power, which her fancy told her she still possessed, of bringing on a renewal of his addresses. So she kind of examines that whole spectrum of feelings that she's had there. She is astonished that it's clear he's willing to forgive her. She's recognizing her own bad behavior. So if Darcy has changed, Elizabeth has changed as well. And I love this idea that we can only attribute that to love. And I just think that's very, very sweet. And so the next day they are headed back to Pemberley, this time as invited guests. And that picks us up in chapter 45. But that was like a huge chunk right there. I think that was like the first 30 pages of our section today.
One thing I did want to bring up, though, I thought it was interesting because Elizabeth had been given all of these impressions of what Miss Darcy would be like. You know, everybody's like, oh, she's so accomplished. There was never a more beautiful young lady. And she's so wonderful and so perfect.
And she tried to run off with Wickham. She knows and that she, about her too.
Yeah, she knows that about her too. And then she sees her. It says she had heard that Miss Darcy was exceedingly proud, but the observation of a very few minutes convinced her that she was only exceedingly shy. And she's like trying to carry on a conversation with her. She only gets monosyllabic responses. But what I think is good and interesting about Elizabeth is that where if it was Darcy who had done it many months ago in Hertfordshire, she'd been like, oh, he's rude and proud and all these things. But now she has also let go a lot of her prejudice. And now she sees, oh, Georgiana is actually just shy. And so these monosyllabic responses are just her being shy and a little insecure with herself. And she also says that she's tall and like larger built than Elizabeth. And she's womanly and graceful, but maybe not as handsome as everybody says. She says she's not as handsome as her brother. And it's like, well, she's cute, but she's not. So just, you know,
just kind of state
the knockout. Yeah.
And I wonder too, like if Elizabeth had met her several months before, would Elizabeth have been inclined to recognize that she's just shy? Or would Elizabeth have said, oh, she's just like her brother?
That's kind of what I was thinking is that she probably, you know, she softened towards both of them. And maybe she also is beginning to see that Darcy's behavior at Hertfordshire was also some shyness and not so much necessarily trying to be super rude, but it was sort of his defense mechanism because he's quite shy. And here in Derbyshire, he's absolutely in his element. It's his grounds. Everybody's on his turf now. And so he's able to let loose a lot more and be more of the man that he really is.
Well, and maybe when we meet new people or approach them, if in the front of our mind, we can view that like through the lens of like, I'm hoping to like this person or, you know, like we walk into a situation with less judgment, then maybe it's easier to see what's really there versus what we want to see. I don't know. I think Elizabeth would have perceived Miss Darcy really differently several months before.
Yeah.
Yeah. How often do we like attribute somebody's rudeness or their dislike for us, that's what we think, but they're actually just shy or awkward or they don't know what to say. I don't know. I was in a situation this week where I went to a birthday party and it was a relative's birthday party. And they like have never liked me after it. I was like, yeah, he never said a word to me. Well, I never said a word to him either. And so like I go into that situation with this attitude, right? Where I should have went into it like, hey, I'm going to go say, you know, happy birthday and be kind. And maybe he's just shy. Anyways.
You're going to let your civility and your good manners save you when you don't know what else to say.
And then I was like, I was complaining to my mom about it. And I'm like, well, he didn't really talk to anybody.
Our brains are so interesting. We get laser focused on what we want to look for. And then we find those things.
Yes, like her, right? In the beginning, she has all this evidence for how awful he is because that was her first impression of him, right? And now, once you have that, maybe that's why it was called first impression. Once you have that, then she's like undoing all of those thoughts. But now she's accumulating evidence for him being kind, which is harder because of the first thoughts she had about
him. I have to let go a lot of other notions.
Yeah. So. But then that's all we see is, oh, now I'm gathering evidence for him being a good man. So on to chapter 45. Nan had mentioned that they were invited back to Pemberley as guests. So the next morning, Darcy, Bingley, and Mr. Gardner go fishing while Elizabeth and Mrs. Gardner go visit the ladies at Pemberley. Now, this time, Bingley's sisters are there, unfortunately. So Caroline Bingley and Mrs. Hurst are not happy to see Elizabeth. At least they do not appear to be happy. And she's kind of wondering, like, do I want Darcy to come back or do I not want him to come back? Which would be better, because this is awkward. He does come back. And that's when Caroline tries to embarrass Elizabeth in front of him by mentioning Wickham, but not understanding that that actually backfires because it mortifies Georgiana. Caroline was trying to take the spotlight off of Elizabeth later, but it also backfires. She says all these awful things about Elizabeth, like how she looks and, right? Isn't that pretty much how she looks? Like what her face looked like? And I should have put that in there. But
I mean, it's kind of the lowest of the low, because she's just like, how very ill Miss Eliza Bennet looks this morning. She's so tan and everybody said that she was so beautiful, but she's not pretty, you know. Like this very it's like her last middle school girl.
Yeah. It's like her last ditch effort, and she's not reading the room. she's doing is making herself look so bad.
I think this is one of the first lessons you learn in elementary school is like you saying bad things about other people actually just makes you look bad. And like, she did not get that lesson as a 5-year-old. So yes, she says all this horrible stuff about Elizabeth, trying to take the spotlight off of her. But then it says the very circumstance which had been designed to turn his thoughts from Elizabeth seemed to have fixed them on her more and more cheerfully. So it's making Caroline look worse and Elizabeth look better. And then after Elizabeth leaves, Caroline tries again. He says, it is many months since I have considered her as one of the handsomest women of my acquaintance. So he's like, actually, she's one of the most beautiful women I've known. So what you just said did not work.
This is my sticky note on that page. It's just got a big heart on it. Because I love that like whole thing. This is the first time Darcy really like puts the set down on one of these women. Like he should have been for a long time. He's just kind of ignored things, or he's been like kind of less direct with her. But in this, I mean, he just shut her up. Miss Bingley was left to all the satisfaction of having forced him to say what gave no one any pain but herself.
I feel kind of bad for her. She's super dumb. He shuts her down. Then it ends up just hurting her. I don't know. Poor girl. She just has no clue. And then in 46, so they're back at the inn, and this is when Elizabeth gets two letters. Now, she had been expecting letters, but one had gotten lost, so they kind of come together. The first letter has the shocking news that Lydia has run off with Wickham to get married in Scotland. That's shocking. The second letter is even worse. So Colonel Forster had learned that Wickham had no intention of marrying Lydia and that they had both just gone to London and they were there. So the Colonel and Mr. Bennet had gone to London to search for them. Mrs. Bennet is back at home and she's a total mess. She can't like come out of her bedroom. And Jane is asking Elizabeth to come home immediately and is also asking if Mr. Gardner will go help his brother and their father in London. She's panicked. Like, I think in the book, it gets this impression like she just kind of gets up and starts running. I got to get out of here. I got to go fix this. Which is funny because I think she's the one in the family that is like the fixer. I have to go home because nobody else at home can handle all this. So as she's running out,
Elizabeth is the one practical enough to handle things without melting down. Like, yes. Jane is good to like listen, but Jane never like pushes back, or Jane sometimes struggles to see things as they really are because she's like the rose-colored glasses, right? So I think Elizabeth is the one person in her family that is just practical enough to kind of see things as they are and hard-headed enough to make hard choices.
And she knows it. As she's running out, then she meets Darcy at the door and she tells him the story of the letters. And she is sure that all of this is her fault because she and Jane didn't expose Wickham's what they knew about him. And she thinks, if I had, this wouldn't have happened. At the end, doesn't it kind of allude to the fact that she's worried that this might affect her chances of rekindling the relationship with Darcy?
Not even just ruined. She thinks it's a done deal now. She's like, if there was any chance he was going to renew his address, it will never happen now. She fully expects that to be done.
Is this the first time when you get that she really does want him to readdress her, ask her again?
Well, I think she's been headed that way, but I think once she realizes there's no chance of it, she's recognizing how deeply
she wanted it.
Disappointed she is. And it's going to be really hard for her because this is with their families in crisis. So this isn't something she can think about or talk about. Her concerns right now are very secondary to what's going on with this horrifically selfish sister.
I love how many topics are like off limits here.
And this is the first time, too, when she's like, you know, if I'd said what I know Wickham to be, this is the first time Wickham's name has passed between them since the letter. So the other thing this fully indicates here, because they haven't talked about any of that yet.
Yeah.
They've like papered it over, right? And so by her saying this, this is the first inkling Darcy has that Elizabeth like fully ingested that letter and is kind of back on his side again. There was one other time it was slightly alluded to, is that when they were at the house before, Miss Bingley is making digs at Elizabeth about the militia and how much her family liked them. And even though she wouldn't directly say Wickham's name, it's clear that that's what she's alluding to. And because Miss Bingley has no idea that Miss Darcy was going to run away with Wickham, she's causing a lot of pain in a situation that she doesn't realize she's inadvertently causing pain. And there's a moment where Elizabeth and Darcy actually kind of share a look with each other. And it's kind of that first time too, you get this, like, you know, when people start to get close to each other, they can communicate without using words. Mm-hmm. This is the first time you sort of see them like look at each other and recognize more is going on than is being said. They work to change the subject so that Miss Darcy can feel comfortable again, but she never speaks in the conversation again after Wickham is alluded to. She's like clams up. But I do think there's this kind of moment that passes between Elizabeth and Darcy. It's the first time they're able to communicate in kind of a sweet, unspoken way that indicates a deeper understanding and affection growing between them. I mean, Lydia's news is doubly devastating. It's horrible for their family, but Elizabeth is like, he'll never ask now, because then there's this double whammy. Like, it's not just that there's scandal attached to her family. It's that Wickham would be his brother-in-law. He would never be free of Wickham after this. He's hoped to never see Wickham again. And there would be no avoiding him if he married into her family now.
Yeah, that's one of her big concerns. First of all, like you said, he had already expressed to her his concerns of being connected to her family because they were quite lacking in propriety. And then her sister goes off and does like the worst thing that a young girl can do at that point in time, only like proving more kind of what he said. And then, you know, everybody's hoping, oh, they're going to get married. That would make Wickham a brother-in-law. She's feeling like there's no hope at all.
I kept thinking like they desperately want, I don't know, times are different, right? Like they desperately want him to marry her. And I think nowadays that you'd be like, no, just leave, just go away.
Yeah, it's just, but yeah, again, just like such a different time, because once she had, nowadays you can come back from something like that. Yes. Back then you couldn't as a young woman. They're just.
Yeah, in my mind, like having him connected to them forever is worse.
Goes back to the previous chapter. As they leave Pemberley after they've met his sister, Elizabeth is in the carriage with her aunt and uncle. They talk to his sister his friends, his house, his fruit, of everything but himself. I love that line. It's yes. just, you know, when you have an awkward topic and you're not sure how to bring it up. I think this is so classic, like as parents work, as you're working with your kids, like sometimes you'll talk about everything but what you really want to talk about because you're just hoping to draw them out. And it doesn't always work. Until they're ready, they won't talk.
And that's exactly what Mrs. Gardner says, because at this point she's completely convinced. And so she's like, really, really wanted to talk about it, but she felt like Lizzie needed to be the one to bring it up. And Lizzie just wouldn't.
Thinking of these letters too, Lydia's just not, she's really young. She's not the brightest. It becomes pretty plain to me that Wickham has made promises to her he has no intention of keeping, which is probably how he got her to run away with him in the first place. You know, he's the one that's gaslighting her, I'm sure, to some degree. It would be very interesting to see what these conversations look like. Recently, there's been a book released. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's called Mrs. Wickham. It's the story from Lydia's perspective.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah. I don't know how much fun it will be. I don't think Lydia's going to end up with much of a life married to this guy.
Well, you're right. Not fun, but it's always fun to me to see somebody like jump in and get
perspective,
a take. Yeah.
All of this is really, really hard.
The next several chapters, if there was a title for this section, we could call it just letters, because there are many, many letters. And it does start with Jane's in the previous chapters. But 47 finds Elizabeth and the Gardners. They're heading back to Longbourn as quickly as possible. They had left their inn within about an hour. And they're just talking about the whole situation. Mr. Gardner, he's such a good man. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to go help in any way that I can. We're going to figure this out, you know. So Lizzie had read them, Jane's letters. And so they're kind of like picking it apart and really analyzing it. And they're like, but maybe Jane's right. Like maybe he really does like Lydia, because like she has no money. Why would he just go off with her unless he intended to marry her? And maybe he really, really does like her. And Lizzie is, again, looking at it from a very practical point of view. And I think they're looking at it thinking, yeah, he's not the best guy, but there's got to be some honor in him. And she's like, no, there's no honor in him at all. And so this is purely a carnal venture, honestly. And so because they had originally thought that they were going to Scotland, and I was interested in that because I thought maybe going to Scotland was akin to like going to Vegas. Like, I don't know, like, because they were saying, well, they were going to go right to Scotland. That would imply they're getting married right away. But then they didn't go to Scotland. They're pretty sure they're in London. And they're thinking they maybe would still get married, but it would take a longer time if they're in London.
Get married in England at this time, there was kind of two ways that you could get married in a church. So the first was that they'd say you'd had the banns read, which for 3 weeks in church, like basically the minister would stand up and announce the intention of two people to get married. And does anybody have any objection to this? And they would do that 3 times. And then once the banns had been read 3 times, then they could get married after that. The other way is that they could apply directly to like the Archbishop of Canterbury or somebody of his equivalent for what they could call a special license, which meant they could get married quickly. And that was hard to get an audience with somebody who could grant a special license. And so that would be more of an aristocratic thing to do. But Scotland didn't have any rules around that. Like, so in Scotland, you could just like jump the border and get married. That's why in these, and Gretna Green, I think, is on the road from London. Gretna Green is like the first town that you come to across the border. And so in these novels, it's always like, they're going to go to Gretna Green, right? That's the big fear. And it is definitely the equivalence of like going to the drive-through wedding chapel in Vegas. That's kind of what it
is. That's so funny. Like 200 years ago, they had a Vegas.
Yeah.
I love it. I'm sure that lots of people back then did not love it, especially if their kids were involved in that. But anyway, so Lizzie is like going through this practically. She's like, they didn't go to Scotland. She's like, Lydia doesn't have any brothers to step forward for her and speak for her honor. Wickham knows that my father is pretty just like, whatever. He probably doesn't think my father is going to do anything about this. She just goes through all these things. She's like, Lydia, she's never been taught to think on anything seriously. And so she would just like fly off and do whatever. I love that the Gardeners are like, well, but Jane doesn't think this, you know, so badly of Wickham. Lizzie is like, okay, but Jane doesn't think ill of anybody. And I thought that was interesting. I was like, unfortunately, being too kind and too positive and too optimistic all the time sometimes leads to lacking a bit of credibility, you know? While it is important to be positive and optimistic, it's also important to be realistic too, or else, at least in this case, she lost a little bit of credibility because she says, well, look, Jane knows as well as I do what Wickham is. And he's a profligate in every sense of the word. In other words, he's just very extravagant and very stupid with his money. And we find out that he has left debts everywhere and he's a gamer. In other words, like a gambler. And she also talks about how he had lied about the entire Pemberley family to Lizzie. Wickham is just the worst. She can't believe anything good about him. And so she feels like it really, they're on a road to destruction. But she does say too, she's like, you know, because she's kind of blaming herself because she knew what Wickham was. She hadn't told anybody. But she's like, but the thing is, like, I didn't think there would really be a need. She's like, they were leaving Hertfordshire. Never saw any indication that, you know, there was any attraction between him and Lydia. So the fact that she was going to Brighton, there were no red flags, like didn't even think about it. Obviously, she's kicking herself now. They finally arrive back at Longbourn. Jane has been handling things as well as she can by herself. Like you say, you know, she's not like super like proactive. She's not, but she's just sort of like trying to hold down the emotional fort. Her mother is just like in her room, just in hysterics. And it says like, and crazy.
Easy.
Yes. Like
getting obsessed about clothes.
And of course, like she's blaming everybody. She's like, Lydia wouldn't do this. There have to be some other things at work here. You know, she's such a good girl. She never did. She's, and it says she blames everybody but herself. Of course, Mr. Bennett is gone. He is in London and trying to do something. He'd said that he would write. He hadn't written very much. They don't really know what's going on in London. Again, going back to Mrs. Bennett, she's like, I'm sure there was some great neglect or other on the Forster side, for she's not the kind of girl to do such a thing if she had been well looked after. And she sort of like blames Mr. Bennett. She's like, I thought we should all go to Brighton, but of course I was overruled, as I always am. And then she starts going down the slippery slope of logical fallacy. She's like, I know Mr. Bennett will find Wickham, and then Wickham will challenge him to a duel, and then Wickham will kill him, and then we'll be turned out by the Collins, and then what are we going to do?
Later on, she's mad when the dad's coming back home. She's mad. She's like, well, who's going to fight Wickham now?
I know. She's just like the most unreasonable, irrational lady. But I really love something that Mr. Gardner said here, because of course you can see like Mr. and Mrs. Gardner just going, oh my gosh, why are we the most rational people in the room? He says, do not give way to useless alarm. Though it is right to be prepared for the worst, there is no occasion to look on it as certain. And I was like, that's kind of a good line for life. But he was trying to just calm her down and be like, listen, we do need to be prepared, but like, don't let it destroy you. There's no reason for that. There's more of life ahead, basically. But then, yeah, she's now after Mr. Gardner. You need to go to London. You need to help Mr. Bennett find them and make them get married. And the wedding clothes. Don't let Lydia make any decisions before she's talked to me, because she doesn't know the best warehouses, guys. Oh, my gosh. Mr. Gardner's like trying to kindly bring her off of her bizarre ledge. Later on, Lizzie sort of takes Jane aside and is like, hey, tell me everything that you haven't told me. And Jane sort of gives more of an account of this, of Colonel Forster's part in all this. He had really like done everything that he could. He'd gone to many different places trying to seek them out. He'd talked to so many people. I think he had even come there to Longbourn to talk to them about it. He said that in talking to Denny and some of other of Wickham's comrades in arms, he was like, yeah, he didn't have any intention of ever marrying Lydia. That wasn't going to happen. And he was kicking himself as well. Like, everybody's blaming themselves. He's like, you know, I could tell that Lydia was starting to like him, but I didn't sense anything to be worried about. But basically, he's like, I should have watched them more carefully. He also gives them more insight into Wickham. He's like, basically, he used to like him, but he found that he was very, it says, imprudent and extravagant. He left Meryton greatly in debt. And same with Brighton. He had left Brighton in a huge amount of debt. Also, Jane shares this note that Lydia had left with Mrs. Forster right as she was leaving. And this is when she says, we're going to Gretna Green. And I'm so excited to write to my family and sign my name, Lydia Wickham. And it was so stupid and extremely irritating, but it does show Lizzie and Jane that Lydia was quite certain they were going to be getting married. She had been convinced that that was going to happen.
I don't know where it is, but at some point, Mrs. Bennett says, like you had said, I think Colonel Forster was like, I should have watched him better. And everybody's like, we should have been watching better. But she says, she's never been a problem as long as she was watched over really closely.
As long as you're helicopter parenting this 16-year-old, she's going to be fine.
Yeah. I thought that was really.
She has no self-control. That's what I'm saying.
She was always going to get away. Something was going to happen.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it's like saying, well, your 2-year-old is going to be fine out in the street as long as you're right there with them. But they have no judgment and they have no real control over themselves at this point. They don't have any knowledge. And Lydia is just, she was just a disaster waiting to happen. So
just before we go on, and this goes back a little ways, but when Elizabeth finds out about all of it and she's in front of Mr. Darcy, when she finds out about it, she says, but nothing can be done. I know very well that nothing can be done. How is such a man to be worked on? How are they even to be discovered? I have not the smallest hope. It's in every way horrible. But this line, how is such a man to be worked on? We already know it's money. Money is Wickham's whole thing. It's why he went after Georgiana in the first place. It's why he keeps treading on the Darcy name. And of anybody in the situation who has any money, it's Mr. Darcy. So it's kind of interesting that how is such a man to be worked on? Money is the only language that Wickham really speaks. The other kind of insight they give about Lydia's character here is Elizabeth had no difficulty in believing that neither virtue nor understanding would preserve her from falling into easy prey. You look at teenage girls, you're around teenage girls, when does harmless flirtation cross some kind of line into behavior that's just really inappropriate? And that is obviously where Lydia was. There's also a line later on, and it's not marked here, but there is a line that indicates that Lydia was just going to be willing to run off with the first person that asked.
Yeah.
It wasn't really about Wickham so much as it was about just getting to run away.
Opportunity.
Yeah. And again, I think, and we may have talked about this before, but I do think we have to be very careful, especially coming from a culture where marriage and family is really, really highly sought after and valued. I think we need to be really careful as we work with girls, especially, that it isn't just about getting married. It's about being married to the right person, and that their value does not stem from whether or not marriage and family happens for them. Their value is intrinsic and inherent. A marriage is a nice addition to your life, but it certainly shouldn't be the only thing that matters. Lydia is the tail end of these 5 girls, and she's watched for thinking of the age Jane is, the mom for probably almost a decade has done nothing but prepare for the time when her girls would come out and get a husband. And so Lydia is enough younger. So from the time Lydia was a young girl, she has viewed everything in her life as the be all and end all is the manhunt. And whether that was communicated to her, directly or indirectly is another story. But I know years ago growing up, I had a friend that was like this. She was one of the younger girls in a family full of big girls. When the oldest daughter got married, the mother took them all wedding dress shopping and said, everybody has to like it because you're all going to wear it. And that happened. I mean, she was an aunt by age 7 or 8, right? Because she was the younger one in a family full of girls. And I just remember this one friend I don't remember her ever not having a boyfriend. She's in a really good place now in her life, but it's taken her a long time to come to that place. I don't know if she understood her own identity very well, independent of a man or a boy. I think that's the real harm that Miss Bennett's done to her daughters here, is that I think she has too closely tied their worth to whether or not they can get married. And I know she's a product of her time, but she's also a cautionary tale for our time. And it makes me really, really grateful to live in a time when my identity is independent. I mean, now it is less so now that I've had a husband and a family for years and years and years. But my mom and dad both did a good job of me in my early 20s not making me feel like I would be less to them if marriage wasn't part of my plan.
So I think we have a lot to be grateful for in Jane Austen herself, and just making it so obvious and evident how destructive this line of thinking is and can be. Because like you say, Mrs. Bennet was not an unusual mom that way. She wasn't some toxic out there person. I mean, it was quite toxic, but it was also extremely normal.
And as Austen, who's 100 years ahead of her time.
Well, absolutely.
And I think the other thing with this section too is this is one thing that, you know, again, like Austen's writing from a more genteel standpoint here, and her own, like we've talked about before, like her own limited experience regarding men and like male culture and all those kind of things. It was not uncommon for the aristocracy in this time. The men would get married older, the women were younger. The women were expected to be chaste, the men were not.
Right.
Not in any way. In fact, it was seen as like quite the opposite. It was unexpected. It was expected that men would philander, that they would run around, they would have relationships. And men of a high enough class with enough money very often had a mistress. And they would sometimes keep that mistress even after their marriage, meaning that like your legitimate heir and sexual desire, these two things were not part of the same thing.
Right.
And this idea of love matches, that one person could fulfill all of that, was kind of new and different. When women were looked so down on or so compartmentalized as being of certain types, you know, like one woman couldn't be all of these things. There's women that you want to sleep with. And then there's women that are okay to marry. And then there's a nanny to raise your children. Like this idea that women could only be one type of thing. And so these wealthy men would have lots of different kinds of women in their lives to fulfill. You'd have a housekeeper and her job would be different too. You'd have all these different women in your life to fill these different roles because women were seen as less than. And so there's no way that you could like have a woman in your life that could possibly fill all those positions because such a woman didn't exist. This idea that like Lydia now having done what she did, if not for some serious intervention that's about to come up here, Lydia would only be fit for like becoming the mistress of some man somewhere. Yeah. And a lot of times after women had done this kind of thing, especially if they couldn't get married or she ends up pregnant, they would be kicked out of their families. And a lot of times they would fall into prostitution or there'd be, you know, like when the suffrage movement came along, the prostitution that was evident in London was just rampant. Part of the purpose of the women's suffrage movement was also anti-prostitution. Because it was such a part of the culture, again, because women were kept from employment or any kind of progression outside just men protecting them. So,
yeah. And there were only so many things that they could do
to
provide for themselves or their children. And
that's the seedy underbelly that Austen alludes to, but doesn't like necessarily describe. You read Dickens to get the seedy underbelly or Victor Hugo, right? Like you want to see like what the flip side of this looks like after women become fallen. It's not pretty. The other funny thing I found in this section too is that Mary gets very sermonizing. Elizabeth has no inclination of replying. So Mary again will make these long speeches that nobody answers or talks to her.
Yeah. And it even is very clear that Elizabeth is just, she says nothing. She's like, I have nothing to say. She has stuff to say and she uses lots of big words, but it's in the end, it's like not saying anything that everybody doesn't already know.
I can't even.
Just jumping, we're going to go through 48 really quickly. So back at Longbourn, they still haven't heard anything from their father. He had promised to write and he just hasn't. But Meryton, it's just really a buzz with now all these stories of how Wickham is the worst because they've heard that he and Lydia have run off. And so now they're all like, oh yeah, he did this and he did this and he's so dishonorable and we don't like him. And it says everybody began to find out that they had always distrusted the appearance of his goodness. You know, oh, well, now that you say it, I guess he wasn't that great. Well, and again, like he had left debt everywhere.
It's like $100,000 in debt.
Yeah, like a lot in each place that he was going. So back in London, Mr. Gardner is desperately trying to help Mr. Bennet, who also seems like he's pretty just like in a daze, but they're trying so hard to find Wickham and Lydia. That is the trick. They have no idea where they are. And Mr. Gardner kind of writes, because Mrs. Gardner has stayed at Longbourn to help a little bit. And he writes and he's like, I wonder if there's any way that Lizzie would know of any connections that Wickham would have that we could somehow get a clue to where he might be. And it really comes out that he has no family. He really doesn't have any close friends. And so nobody really knows. Just sort of to add insult to injury, they receive this delightful letter from Mr. Collins that is extremely, oh my gosh, just so. But the thing is, like, Jane Austen has set it up in such a way that you saw it coming. It's not unexpected. It is very on point with his character for him to write this letter. And he says things like, the death of your daughter would have been a blessing in comparison to this. This licentiousness of behavior in your daughter has proceeded from a faulty degree of indulgence. But I'm inclined to think that her own disposition must be naturally bad. You are grievously to be pitied.
About repentance. Isn't he a clergyman?
Yeah, he doesn't understand what he pretends to be preaching. So, and he also alludes to the fact he's like, well, I'm kind of grateful that Lizzie didn't accept me last year, because if she had, I'd be tied in with you. He does not say that specifically, but that is what he is alluding to here. And then he encourages them basically to like cut her off. He says, throw off your unworthy child from your affection forever and leave her to reap the fruits of her own heinous offense.
He also says he's told Lady Catherine the whole story.
Yeah. And so, of course, she has weighed in on it, which that's always delightful. Mr. Gardner writes again and tells them that, again, they found out that Wickham has no relations, but they did find out that he has more than £1,000 that would be necessary to clear his expenses at Brighton. And again, and that is the same at every place he's been at. He also says that Mr. Bennet is going to be coming home. And this is when Mrs. Bennet is like, but if he comes home, who's going to be there to fight Mr. Wickham and make him marry her? And at this point, Lizzie is going, okay, I wish that Darcy didn't know about this. Says, had she known nothing of Darcy, she could have borne the dread of Lydia's infamy somewhat better. But she knows that there's Darcy, who's this great man, and he knows about the whole thing. And that's just mortifying to her. And so Mr. Bennet gets home. He's saying that he basically blames himself completely. He feels like he's been way too just indulgent and devil may care sort of with, especially with his younger daughters, maybe with all of them. But he's like, well, I've learned my lesson and we're going to do things very differently from now on. And he's like, no soldier is ever coming into the house, nor even to pass through the village. Balls will be absolutely prohibited unless you stand up with one of your sisters. He's saying all this to Kitty. And you're never to stir out of doors till you can prove that you have spent 10 minutes of every day in a rational manner. Because Kitty was like, listen, if I went to Brighton, I wouldn't behave like that. And he's like, you're never going to Brighton. That's not happening. And so he lays down the law. And then he's like, well, don't worry. If you're a good girl for the next 10 years, I will take you to a review at the end of them. Of course, at the end of 10 years, she'd be like in her very late 20s. And so that's devastating to her. But that's just the point that he's at.
After, you know, there's more letters that are going to pass back and forth. But the biggest thing that we find is that they've been discovered. They're not married, nor can I find there was any intention of being so. He probably did talk Lydia into coming with him under the auspices that he would marry her, but clearly he never intended to, because there was no money. It was more that because his debts were catching up to him, it was more like he had to get out of Dodge. And when he realized he could talk Lydia into coming with him so he didn't have to go alone and he could have a companion, he took her with him. I know that when I first read this, when I was in high school, I was really, really naive about this. I thought they were kind of just waiting to get married. I didn't really understand that clearly they were like living together in like an intimate way, right? Because Austen is very discreet. She doesn't really say that, but it's everywhere implied. Although even the appearance of indiscretion could force a man into a marriage, like back in the day. Money amounts are thrown around. This equal share of the £5,000 secured among your children after he dies. So Lydia is going to be entitled to about $100,000 inheritance, maybe a little less than that. During her life, she's supposed to get £100 a year, which is only about $9,000, like in today's money. You know, Mr. Bennet, as he reads this, he realizes she costs me more than that now. It's actually going to be cheaper for me to foist her off. So he just feels like the money isn't adding up, and he knows he's going to have to discharge some of the debts that are there in Meryton. That's kind of like been part of the deal. but the sums are kind of unusual to think mm-hmm. about. And then Mr. Bennett, after he reads the letter, he's like, how am I ever going to pay back my brother? And she's like, well, what do you mean? This doesn't look too bad. And he said, yeah, but the debts had to be discharged. He said, I think Wickham would have been a fool to take her for a penny less than 10,000 pounds. Right. 10,000 pounds is pretty close to $1 million. So this is between like covering his debts, making sure his commission is purchased and that he has a way to move forward with his life, helping them get established and settled. And so 10,000 pounds, I mean, yeah, like you say, $1 million, that's a sum that feels like astronomical. Well, it feels pretty huge for the Bennets also. They don't have that kind of money. So they aren't sure exactly where the sum is coming from. And we know, as Elizabeth alluded to earlier, like what convinces such a man? How is he to be worked on? Well, money is the only thing that works on him. So odds are that there's been somewhere like some kind of pound settlement on him. Once they've discovered them and they pulled Lydia out of the house and made her stay with the gardeners until the wedding takes place. And it's during this time that poor Mrs. Gardner is trying to talk to her. Mm. And Lydia just won't. Listen, it seems pretty clear that Lydia at this point, she might not be really capable of remorse or guilt, either because she is just like so flighty and young and kind of ignorant and doesn't understand, or because she just doesn't care. And then Elizabeth says this about her sister. Well, she's talking about the gardeners and how generous they are to Lydia at this time when they could have really just like walked away. If such goodness does not make her miserable now, then she will never deserve to be happy. What a meeting for her when she first sees my aunt. So if such goodness does not make her miserable now, in other words, what she's saying is if she can't feel like a little bit bad over what she's done when the gardeners have treated her with such generosity, then she probably doesn't ever really deserve to be happy. So this idea that like our happiness comes from like understanding when we've done wrong things and trying to change them, I think is kind of an interesting point there. And then Jane, ever naive Jane, their mutual affection will steady them. I flatter myself they'll settle quietly, live in a rational manner, and in time maybe make their past imprudence forgotten. You know, that's Jane speaking of things that probably will never come to pass. And Elizabeth indicates that their conduct has been such as neither you nor I nor anybody can ever forget it. It's useless to talk of it, right? So Elizabeth kind of seeing the glass half empty there, Jane seeing it half full. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. Mrs. Bennett is overjoyed when she gets this letter and then begins to feel like, well, of course, her uncle has to settle this on her. He should have in the beginning, right? Like, why do we need to feel indebted to my brother? We see where Lydia's personality is coming from in the mother's mm-hmm. response here. Now, the other thing that I think is really sad about the end of this chapter is Lizzie and Jane have tried to do all the right things. And they have been there for the beginning, for their parents, for their family. They've tried to shield their family from the censure of the outside world. They behaved impeccably. Lizzie has this moment at the end of all of it where she's like, Darcy will just never come back. Like, why would he ally himself to Mr. Wickham, this one man who has continually caused Darcy and his family pain forever? Why on earth would he want anything to do with our family? And he'll keep Bingley away too. So I just think it's kind of this sad moment where like Jane and Lizzie have tried to do all the right things and it's Lydia who's going to end up happy. Or at least married first. And in Lydia's mind, that's what happiness looks like, is to get married. You know, sometimes like in life, there's just infuriating unfairness, right? Like people who make mistakes, sometimes pretty egregious mistakes, end up at least temporarily, it looks like they get what they want. And I think Lizzie learns a real lesson here in infuriating unfairness, and that sometimes life just feels kind of yucky. And she's having that moment. Absolutely. So in chapter 50, Mr. Bennett realizes kind of financially he's made some mistakes over the years. And one of those huge mistakes is they just always assumed that there would be a son. And because they always assumed that there would be a son, he never figured that the entailment would be such an issue. But now like the money constraints seem like worse than ever. He realizes that this has caused him very little pain or effort on his part, other than the initial shock of it all. However, the money has been discharged. He's not really being asked to put up very much. Then the mother, on the other hand, the marriage of a daughter, which had been the first object of her wishes since Jane was 16, was now on point of accomplishment. and her thoughts and her words ran wholly on the attendance of those elegant nuptials, fine muslin, and so on. So it's very, again, kind of rubbing this into like Jane and Elizabeth, who didn't get married last year as she had hoped, indicating that like the mother's, again, she doesn't really care how it's accomplished as long as it is. The father, their dad, does push back on sending Lydia any money for wedding clothes. Mm-hmm. He finally asserts himself just a little bit. And the other way he asserts himself is that Mrs. Bennet starts to get delusions of grandeur about them like moving into the neighborhood and just being part of things without any clue for how little money they're really going to have and that they're going to have to keep traveling with the regiment, right? But she wants Lydia to move into the neighborhood. Her husband says this, Mrs. Bennet, before you take any or all of these houses for your son and daughter, let us come to a right understanding. Into one house in this neighborhood, they shall never have admittance. I will not encourage the impudence of either by receiving them at Longbourn. Even initially, he's like, you know, we settled on their marriage and that's fine. I'm glad she's married, but they are never coming to our house. And of course, this is all turned around very shortly because they do negotiate and decide to make a stop at Longbourn before they have to join the militia. Again, thinking about Mr. Darcy, his rational expectation would not survive such a blow as this. Lizzie was humbled, grieved, repented, though she hardly knew of what. She became jealous of his esteem, meaning Darcy, when she could no longer hope to be benefited by it. She wanted to hear of them when there seemed to be the least chance of gaining any intelligence. She was finally convinced that she could have been happy with him, and now it was no longer likely that they would even meet. So Elizabeth has fallen hard now and has no expectation of ever seeing him again. And she's like, yeah, he's probably somewhere congratulating himself that I didn't say yes to this months ago. Because probably if she had said yes, chances are Wickham might have even pursued Lydia harder, like to try to get some of Darcy's money again.
Yeah.
And we're going to see that Darcy is still playing a role, but she doesn't know that yet. But she does recognize that Darcy would have been the perfect person for her because, and she says now, his talents and dispositions would most suit her because they aren't alike. That would have been good for both of them. Her ease and liveliness would have softened his mind and improve his manners. His judgment, information, and knowledge of the world would have been a huge benefit to her also. And then what she says, I love this line, how Wickham and Lydia were to be supported in tolerable independence she couldn't even imagine. But how little of permanent happiness could belong to a couple who were only brought together because their passions were stronger than their virtue.
Sometimes we talk about like our amphibian level brain, which is like the lowest part of our brain that often means that we will like respond to things in anger or just irrationally. And I think it's at that level that passion and lust are at, you know, when they come first, that's what's leading out. You're not using your thinking brain at all. You're just being led by sort of instinct and just what comes.
They can become, if that's the part of the brain that is allowed to take over, then real love, meaning charitable love, brotherly love, kind love, right, goodness love, it gets overshadowed. It gets
no chance to develop, really.
Passion is stronger than your virtue, then it will be hard to love.
That's probably why like affairs don't usually work out.
Yeah.
Because it's all about passion and like, you know, it's off limits, right? It's like, yeah.
There's a line in a Rosamund Pilchard book. She was describing a man and it said something about him like, by marrying his mistress, he just created a job vacancy. He divorced his wife to marry his mistress and now there's going to be another mistress.
Yeah.
I always think that too. Like you marry you have an affair, you get married. Well, now you know that he could just do it again or she could just do it again.
Yeah, so absolutely. And that's like usually what happens, right? If it ever even gets to marriage, like it seems like it rarely ever even gets there. It
just causes so much hurt.
Oh, yeah.
So there was one place where this showed up. It's General Blank's regiment. That yes. Blank. I did do a quick look up on that. It is kind of what we said. If it's in a place name, it's usually because the author is trying to indicate like this could happen anywhere. Maybe this could be happening to you, right? Like that's to make it seem more realistic. So you can kind of put your own mind in there of where it's taking place. If it's in the case of a person, she's not wanting to use real names for things. And at this time, there wouldn't have been that many generals. And so she wants to just make it some generic general versus a specific general. They said that like the libel laws and just different things, she's kind of covering her butt here by indicating, like, I'm not talking about any specific person. I'm not trying to put real people into this story. Also, when they are talking about things in some novels, it'll be like more aristocratic people they're talking about. They don't want to like put any real person kind of like under the bus. In more recent times, they don't do it because his time period was long enough ago that nobody cares. But at the time, because she's writing contemporary to when Napoleonic Wars are actually happening and there's real generals and militias and things like that, she's being kind of vague. And she also doesn't want to be accused of like just being factually incorrect. Like there was never a militia in Meryton. So by not saying which militia it was,
yeah,
trying to indicate that it's anything real happened.
That makes good sense. And it's super, it's actually like really, really interesting because it does kind of tell you about the time and just how very careful and meticulous she needed to be.
Okay. So Lydia and Wickham have arrived at Longbourn and they crack me up. They have no clue what they've done. Or they don't care or something, right?
Well, I'm sure Wickham totally does. Lydia is just completely clueless.
Completely out of it. So
she's like, I should get you all a husband.
Yes. She's like, I figured out how.
Sure I like your way of getting husbands.
Yeah, you didn't do a good job with you. But so she's just giddy over her marriage. And her and Wickham act like they have done nothing wrong. In fact, she is making fun of her sisters because she got married first and they had failed in finding marriage match. Lydia and Wickham are there for 10 days. And Elizabeth quickly realizes that Lydia likes Wickham way more than he likes her. He doesn't return the infatuation. She figures that he was running from his debts and just basically wanted, I think Nan or Amity, one of you said that, just wanted to take somebody with him, arm candy or I don't know, something to do, right? So he just chose Lydia because she was very willing to go. Lydia, in passing, mentions to Elizabeth that Darcy had been at their wedding. And then she quickly kind of backtracks and says, oh, wait, that was supposed to be a secret. You weren't supposed to know that. So now Elizabeth is just dying to know why he was there. And so she writes to Mrs. Gardiner, hoping that she might have more information.
Because she says it's a secret. Jane and Lizzie are both there when she's like, I wasn't supposed to tell it's a secret. Jane's like, well, then you shouldn't say anything else. And Elizabeth's like,
No, maybe you should.
No, I want to know.
But of course, she's way too polite to like say that.
And I love that they say 10 days is a short visit. I can't imagine having visitors at my house.
Oh my gosh. I know.
10 days.
I go by the, who was it that said Fish and Company are
after 3 days
the same after 3 days, they start to stink. I think it's true. Like, oh man, it's hard. But yeah, when they're used to staying places for like months, 10 days would be quite short.
Yeah, I thought that was really, just really funny that Lydia and Wickham are just like, I mean, he's either a narcissist and just doesn't care what anybody thinks, and she's just 15, right? And just so dumb.
What do you think of my husband? Is not he a charming man? I'm sure my sisters must all envy me.
Elizabeth's like, if you only knew.
Well, then she pushed ahead of Jane. I'm the married sister. I get to go first now.
I sit on mother's right hand now.
And also, Mrs. Bennet seems to be all in that delusion, too.
Oh, yeah. Like,
she's 100%. Yeah,
it is a pity we didn't all go. I'm so sad all the daughters didn't get ruined.
Yes. And yeah. I love the difference between her and her husband. Like, she, you know, is in this delusion. And he's like, I never want to see them again. He's like, I can't believe they did this. And
yeah,
they're not welcome here.
Yeah. And it sounds like it took some convincing for them to be able to even go to Longbourn, because at first he was like, no, you know, he had that whole speech about they will never be welcome here. And I have to say, at first when I used to read that, I was like, well, because I knew that they would come and visit. So did he mean they could never move in with them? But I'm sure that he did mean that also, but maybe it just initially was like, I really like never want to see him again. But then was convinced that they could come visit for 10 days.
Well, and I think this is his first foray into really trying to do some parenting.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really know how to, he's not handling it very well. And so his first reaction is just, no, they can never come. No, there'll be no money for wedding clothes.
Yeah.
But then I think ultimately his goal is to like, I mean, if you live with all these women and you can like try to keep the peace, that's his goal. And rather than have his wife like vex him and bug him, he'd probably rather just roll over. I mean, I think his basic nature is going to reassert itself here eventually.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to be changed for good or as deeply as it seems like he's changed initially.
Yeah.
Chapter 52. Mrs. Gardner, she sends a long letter back telling the whole story. Darcy had went to London and found them. He had like known this. He'd had a housekeeper, I think, that had left.
Well, it was Mrs. Young who was the one who had taken Georgiana to Ramsgate. So she had been in charge of Georgiana, and it was through her that Wickham had gotten to Georgiana.
And so they're friends.
Yes. Yeah, so he knew that Mrs. Young was in London. He knew that Wickham was in London. It was like put together.
So he goes
and
to her.
I think Mrs. Young and Wickham, to me, they're close enough friends. This indicates they were in it together as kind of a scam.
Yeah, I think so.
I think they put Mrs. Young in place on purpose to get Georgiana away.
He found them. He goes to London. He finds them. He stops Wickham from abandoning Lydia. I guess Wickham's plan was to run off to Europe. So he stops that from happening. And here's where we learn that he negotiated the deal with Wickham with money. So this makes way more sense because everybody's like, why would he marry her? He's not getting enough money out of this. Well, Darcy is going to give him the money. And then he presents this solution to Mr. Gardner where he's going to put up the money, but Mr. Gardner is going to get all the credit for it. So at first, Mr. Gardner is like, no, I don't want to do that. But Darcy argues that he feels like it was his fault that this happened because it was his silence about Wickham and not telling everybody what Wickham's character really was that caused this whole mess or that started this whole mess. Now, the funny thing is that Mrs. Gardner believes that Darcy actually has a different motivation for doing this because she understands what's really going on. Okay, so they're there. So she learns all this from the letter from Mrs. Gardner. And then they've been there for 10 days. Before Wickham leaves, Elizabeth runs into him on a walk. And she tells him that she knows his story. But now that they are brother and sister-in-law, they need to stop talking about the past and arguing with each other.
Something that I thought was kind of interesting was that Mrs. Gardner says it very gently, but basically she says, Darcy did not judge your father to be a person whom he could so properly consult as your uncle, and therefore readily postponed seeing him till after the departure of the former. So because Darcy had gone to the Gardner's house to be like, hey, here's what Wickham and I have decided. Here's what we're going to do. But they weren't immediately available, and he found out that Mr. Bennett was there, and he's like, that's fine. I'm going to wait for Mr. Bennett to go because Mr. Gardner is the one that I can actually have a good business-like conversation. Maybe there's more to it. Maybe he felt like Mr. Bennett was too close to the situation, but I think that he was trying to be respectful, but he also realized that Mr. Bennett was kind of a silly man, not so serious or competent as Mr. Gardner was.
And I think on some level, I think Darcy is still thinking he may propose to Elizabeth and he doesn't want her father's blessing based on
money
obligation.
Like feeling like he had bought him off or something. Yeah, that's really true.
What else I think is funny is Darcy makes all the arrangements, leaves for a couple of days and then comes back for the wedding. And I feel like Darcy, it's like a shotgun wedding, right? Like I feel like part of the reason Darcy showed up at the wedding is to make sure it actually happened.
Yeah.
He was not going to let Wickham off the hook this time. Oh, the conversation that Wickham has with Elizabeth just lies so much, which makes you realize like how much of what he said before that did he ever say anything true? Because he's like, I was surprised to see Darcy in town last month. We passed each other several times. I wonder what he could be doing there.
Yeah.
He's just lying, right? Like, and then she's like, well, it must be something particular to take him there this time of year. And again, we get this like brilliant Austin conversation where everything that's actually being said has nothing to do with the words that are being said.
Yes.
And it's all underneath. And Elizabeth has this brilliant way of like kind of turning things on them. Then, of course, once she realized what Darcy's done, this is the first instance she's seen of his like extreme generosity directed towards her. They owed the restoration of Lydia, her character, everything to him. Oh, how heartily did she grieve over every ungracious sensation she'd ever encouraged, every saucy speech she'd ever directed towards him. She was humbled, but she was proud of him. Proud that in a cause of compassion and honor, he'd been able to get the better of himself. And so in spite of like his extreme dislike of Wickham, he still did this thing because it was the right thing to do.
Yes, and her heart did whisper that he had done it for her.
Yeah. And whether or not he'll ever come back is another story.
Yeah.
There was something he cared about enough to do it for her. Well, yeah. And Mrs. Gardner implies that too. And then in the very end, she's like, I still want to make that walk around the park, a little pair of ponies for going around the...
Don't you love that?
With the Mistress of Pemberley, invite me back and we can make the circuit of the lake.
Yeah, she's like, when you're mistress.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Then Wickham tries to make a dig at Miss Darcy. Did you like her? Well, very much. I've heard indeed that she's uncommonly improved within the past year or two. When I last saw her, she wasn't very promising. I'm very glad you liked her. I hope she'll turn out well. And then I dare say she will. She's got over the most trying age. He tried to run off with Georgiana at the same age Lydia is now.
Yeah.
I mean, and that says a lot about Wickham too. These are young girls. It's gross. It's just gross. Elizabeth's brilliant way of like stabbing right through his lies all the time. And then he implies like, oh, the housekeeper really liked me. She's like, yeah, not so much. I know.
She was afraid you had not turned out well, but she might be wrong from a distance. You know, maybe that's just how she's seeing things, but I did love it. She had these little very sharp jabs throughout.
And I think without like coming right out and saying like, look, I know exactly what you are. Leave me alone. She's sort of done that anyway. And then she held out her hand. He kissed it with affectionate gallantry, though he hardly knew how to look.
So he knows clearly, that
like, her jabs got to him and he recognizes like, oh, she's seeing through me.
There's one time that she does come straight out though. And I really appreciate that. She says, I did hear too, that there was a time when sermon making was not so palatable to you as it seems to be at present, that you actually declared your resolution of never taking orders and that the business had been compromised accordingly. And I guess that's still a little bit roundabout, but it's about as straightforward as these people ever get.
Well, like, then he gaslights her. Because he basically says, well, yeah, but remember, I told you that when we first met. And that is not the way he said it at all.
Not at all.
Trying to say, oh, I've been honest with you from the beginning, honey. Like, I told you all this. But she's too smart to be gaslighted.
I sort of told you all this.
Yeah.
My version, or my sugar-coated version.
Yeah,
my
all version that I
reality.
Wanted.
And, you know, like the classic narcissist, he definitely has his own version of reality.
Oh, yeah.
It could very much be that he believes half of what he says.
Yeah, it's like how much of this is what you said, him actually believing it, and how much of it is him being like narcissist.
Next week we finish it off. What are we going to do?
Have a party. No. No party.
Tackle Hamlet next.
We're doing Frankenstein.
Oh, good.
We got to do it. A book in between that, but we're going to do Frankenstein for
October. I'll have to follow along for sure. My plan is to read Frankenstein this fall. That's my next classic that's on my list.
We're reading it for book club, and I was like, any chance we could double it up? I can't handle two classics. Like,
so that's what I read this week. Is it called What the Wind Knows? I wasn't able to make it to book group. I had a cousin come into town, kind of spur of the moment, but yeah, I adored it. I thought it was great. I had become very, very concerned near the end that it was not going to have a happy ending. And I was going to take a deep breath and be okay with it, because I think that could have been the way it gone. Anyway, the whole thing made sense at the end, and how they got everybody like where they needed to be and in the right timeline. And I love stories about Ireland anyway. Like, I just think it's such a fascinating culture and history and kind of magical. You know, they have like such a rich history of like
lore,
storytelling and lore. Yeah, that's the word for it. And I adored it. I thought it was so, I loved all the characters that, you know, were messy and broken in their ways, but they, and it's an interesting history. I didn't know hardly anything about those early days of the Irish Revolution. I still find Irish history of the 19th century incredibly confusing, but it makes me want to do more research. So
yeah, it does seem like all over the place.
Everybody at book group loved it, and it was so, I just loved it too. Oh my gosh. It's What the Wind Knows by Amy Harmon. Oh, like you said, I didn't think it was going to turn out like it did in the end. And I had accepted that, right? I'm like, okay, this is how
I was sad, but I'd accepted it.
And then I was like, oh, it couldn't have ended better.
Yeah.
It couldn't have. So
yeah, I loved it.
If you
I want to read it. It's going to be on my to be read.
You got to read it. It's probably the best book I've read this year, maybe.
Oh.
I read The Quiet Tenant by Clémence Michelon. She's French. And she has a little bit of an accent, but oh my gosh. So it was about this woman. Well, this man had a woman like in a shed for 5 years. He'd like kidnapped her or whatever and kept her in this shed for 5 years. But he also had a wife and a daughter in the main house. The wife ends up dying and her parents own the house and they're going to sell the house. And so he has to move her. And so he moves her to the house where him and his daughter live. And he's like, you're going to have to live with us in this house, but you can't, like, I have cameras everywhere. You can't go anywhere. He like chains her to the bed at night so she can't escape. You know, he makes up this story of what she's supposed to be for this daughter. Anyways, it was very page turning and like, I needed to know what was going to happen. And you know, stories like that, like, I don't know if you remember Room, are so frustrating because it's like, scream, do something. This is your chance. Why are you not leaving?
I used to teach the book Room. My senior English class used to read that for like contemporary literature. Mm. Yeah, I know that book really well. That's a good one.
It was good. This one was just as good. I really, really, really liked it. I read it in like a day and a half or something, but I would highly recommend it. And it wasn't too graphic at all.
Yeah. So. As tasteful as that kind of topic can be.
Yes. Yeah, especially because I was listening to it and I'm really sensitive to that kind of stuff, especially when I'm listening to it because you can't as easily skip.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't anything I was like uncomfortable with.
So I've been reading The Escape Artist by Jonathan Freeland. I don't know if it would be classified as it's really biography. So it's about, on the front of the book, it says the man who broke out of Auschwitz to warn the world. It's just his life story, really, of Walter Rosenberg. It dives into all of the Holocaust was icky and awful, but Jonathan Freeland, he like spares no details. He like gets down to the nitty gritty and tells you things that I have read many, many World War II books, lots of nonfiction. So I really, you know, get the story from all perspectives, but there's still things in this book that I was like, dang, didn't really know that. So he dives into it, and because this Walter Rosenberg, he was just a teenager when he was first placed into a concentration camp, and he kind of like was jumping around into different camps. Of course, he was a Slovak Jew. So he's taken to, like I said, different camps, and he would like volunteer to be on different like work details and things because he thought, oh, this will like give me a better chance to escape. He was like always looking for a chance to escape. And he'd seen so much, just all the awfulness. You do one wrong step, you fall down or you're weak, you get shot, or you try to escape, you get hung in front of everybody. Like it was awful, but and so he knew that. He knew the SS, the Nazis were just brutal and awful. But it wasn't until he was at Auschwitz and he was assigned to work in Canada. And that's where it became very real to him, like what they were doing when he's like sorting through children's shoes and going through these babies' prams and things. He's like, and I have never seen these people. There's like mass destruction going on. And he actually also worked the ramps, meaning he was one of the prisoners who had to be right there when the trains came in. And like, I don't want to say help, but like he like unloaded people. He wasn't brutal or anything, but he had to be the one to like take their luggage and things like that. And he said like he and the other men would like try to give warnings, but if anything got back to the SS that the people had been warned at all about what was about to happen to them, they were immediately shot. And anyway, it was just obviously just so horrible. And of course it changes you completely, but he was like, I've got to get out of here. He was very convinced that if he was able to escape and go warn everybody, that nobody would get on the trains, because he realized, he was like, all of this is happening because of deception. Like there is deception every single step of the way, even to the point that like, you know, they're loading so many of the Jews had packed in such a way that they could like set up their lives someplace else, you know, and because that's what they thought was happening. That's what got them on the trains to be in that's what got them into the ghettos, not to mention like the machine guns held to their heads and their children. But there wasn't this mass uprising by the millions of Jews as there probably could have been, because they really thought, okay, well, this is bad, but we're just going to be relocated, you know? So he's like, this is all about the deception. I've got to go and warn everybody else and tell the world what's happening so that nobody else will come here. Of course, like I said, he's a teenager and he'd been in the camps for like 3 years, which was a long time at that point. So he didn't have like a huge grasp of what was going on out there. All he knew is that in like 10 months, he had unloaded 300 trains of Jews. So they figure it was about 300,000 people. Anyway, he became a student of escape and was trying to figure out how to do it effectively without getting caught, without getting killed. And so I'm actually just over halfway through and he's just escaped, which involves like staying in one place for 3 days, at which point the SS decides to like bring in their search and like, and shut down the, or stop having this perimeter guard. So then they're able to leave. So yeah, it's very fascinating.
Fascinating, but hard.
Very, very hard, because also, you know, that like no one really listens to him. Like once he gets out.
Because it's too horrible to be believable.
Yeah. Too horrible. Yeah, absolutely.
It's too horrible. I know that that was the book Night. There's a guy that comes back early, kind of escapes from one of the trains or something and comes back to their little village. His name's Moshe. And he tries to warn them.
Yeah.
They just think he's crazy.
Yeah.
They're like, of course this is not happening. This is the 1900s, right? Like this could not happen.
Well, he talks about how there is a prisoner who, there was this woman and her child who got off the train, and one of the prisoners had just, he had just had it, and he just goes up to her and he's like, they are going to kill you. And she was so just affronted by it that she went up to one of the SS guards. And she's like, this man is saying just ridiculous things. I can't believe he would say that to me, that he would say that, that me and my child are going to be like, how dare he say that in front of my child? And the SS officer is like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like that guy, he's just a nut. Of course, they went and shot the man and immediately sent her and her child to the gas chamber. So crazy, yeah. Crazy, crazy stuff. I would recommend it if you... You have to be ready for some heavy, very, very, very heavy.
But if you are, read it. I don't know if I could. I don't know. I've decided lately that I do like dark books where hard things happen to people, but I think I might have a line. I don't know. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, chapters 53-62, which is the end. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.